One of Ronald Reagan's most famous and successful quotes is from his 1980 debate with Jimmy Carter. "There you go again." No one can remember what it was about or whether it was accurate, but it worked. I bring it up because a new book makes clear that that same line applies all too well to the right in this country, the conservative side. "There you go again, bringing up the same old stereotypes, stoking the same old fears, the same old prejudices." Today's guest, Mike Lux, has a new book, The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be, in which he traces the role progressives have played in leading the U.S. to so many of its best advances, battling every time the right's determination to keep progress at bay. Needless to say, we are at another one of those moments today. After 30 years of dominance by the right, disaster is clear to all and change is on the move. We'll talk about the history, the present moment, and what we all need to do to keep moving forward to a more progressive future. Mike Lux is the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies, a political consulting firm. Previously, he was Senior Vice President for Political Action at People for the American Way and served as a special assistant in the Clinton White House. Lux has founded and currently chairs a number of new organizations and projects, including American Family Voices and the Progressive Donor Network. His first book is the one I mentioned, The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. Welcome, Mike Lux.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. Mm-hmm. So take it back as far as you can or as far as you have to. How did you first get involved with politics?
I first got involved in politics when I was a kid, actually. My father was on the school board, and I got involved in, you know, local school board races, city council races when I was very young, and I actually knocked on doors for George McGovern in Nebraska. Had a lot of doors slammed in my face. I was 12 years old, and they still slammed the door in my face. So.
Let me just cut in. My first campaign experience was McGovern as well. I was 24, uh-huh. So I actually ended up running an assembly district.
Oh, great.
But I often thought of it as the children's crusade.
It was in my case, for sure. So anyway, I've always been interested in, you know, since I was real young in politics and history. And was involved, you know, student government, all the way through. And in fact, left college early because I wanted to be an organizer so much and never went back. I was a VISTA worker. I was a, you know, labor organizer, community action organizer. So I've been doing politics and organizing my whole life.
Okay, great. It's interesting how many people who are in the field started, you know, that young.
Yeah.
Let's jump to the present then. You've been active, White House, People for the American Way, your current consulting firm. Why did you write this book?
Well, I've always loved history, and I've always felt like conservatives wrap themselves in the flag and tradition and history, but they would always make false allusions to that history. They didn't know what they were talking about, or they intentionally misled people. And so I really felt like it was important for progressives to understand our history, to understand the folks we stand on the shoulders of, and how folks who are our ideological heirs, our ideological ancestors, if you will, are folks that we can be proud of. And so I just think it's important people understand that history. And what I would find when I was doing my political work, you know, when I was involved in presidential campaigns and all kinds of elections, involved in issue fights, is that the debates would echo the debates I was reading about when I would go home at night and read history. The same logic, same themes, same arguments. In fact, sometimes the exact same language. I would listen to Rush Limbaugh, you know, on the radio ranting. I'd come home and read some quote from some 1800s, you know, right winger, and it'd be the same quote, literally sometimes. I think that kind of history is important for people to understand.
Okay, so I understand you want to remind people of their history. You're a political consultant, so you're looking at how these things. How and why has this history gotten so lost or distorted?
Well, I think part of it is that conservatives do a great job of, you know, of manipulating history. And and part of it is, I think, that a lot of progressives, they get interested in issues, but they don't necessarily know the background of it or the history of it. And I think history is kind of a lost art in this country. Too much of the time, history is taught in a very boring way, you know, dates and facts, and but you don't think about the overarching patterns, the overarching themes of American history, and you don't think about how all of these things are connected. I think a lot of times people who go into history get into very narrow fields, you know, and study, you know, they study the, you know, the South from 1870 to 1884, as opposed.
And you're right. They may write a thesis on that, and they may never get out of that decade for the rest of their lives.
That's right. But history has big patterns, and I think it's important to look back at them. And I think too many progressives don't understand that, and so they can't make the arguments when some conservative fool says that FDR failed, for example, in fighting the New Deal. They don't understand that FDR cut the unemployment rate from 25% to 9% in 4 years. They don't understand that, you know, when people talk about, oh, all the founding fathers thought the same, that John Adams and Alexander Hamilton fought like crazy with Thomas Jefferson, and they fought over the same things we're fighting over today. Like, for example, whether to bail out the banks.
Right.
You know, literally, sometimes the same issues that they were fighting about.
Yeah. You know, I actually, in my other life, teach nonprofits and foundations mm-hmm. about communications. Uh-huh. And what I always say is storytelling.
Absolutely.
Know your individual stories, but know how they all fit a larger narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like that is very much what you're saying people have lost. One, that if they're learning dates and names and those sorts of things, they're not really getting the juicy stories. And then that for both the conservative side and the progressive side, those stories fit a larger narrative. What would you say is the larger narrative of the progressive side?
The larger narrative of the progressive side is that our side has always felt that Thomas Jefferson's words about us all being created equal ought to be taken seriously. We've always believed that democracy was something that we valued and should be expanded. And we've always felt like government ought to be all about helping regular folks and not just the rich and powerful. Those are the common themes that have run through progressivism all these years. And our narrative is that when we have won, when we have pushed those ideas and won those ideas in the political sphere, that the country has really moved forward.
You know, I have to say, I actually happened to see Rush Limbaugh in person earlier this week.
Well, lucky you.
First time. And one of the claims he makes, and I also had looked at a video of his CPAC speech earlier this year, is that conservatives are the ones that really believe all men are created equal and that should be treated equally. He draws the flip conclusion. You probably know this, but he says, whereas, you know, liberals and progressives hate the rich. And so it's like, how do you counter his thing that he says it's us who really believe in the founding fathers in where they came from?
Well, this is a classic example of what I'm talking about, where how conservatives distort history. If you look back on history and you read what conservatives have written, the speeches they've given, they've argued vehemently against the idea of equality and openly many times against the idea of equality. John C. Calhoun, the conservative leader, the guy who really founded modern conservatism in a way, because he was the one who argued for states' rights and for tradition over the abolitionists. Calhoun said that this idea of equality was insane, that it was literally crazy to talk about equality. The social Darwinist said that equality actually hurt society because if you were rich and powerful, you must be that for a good reason.
Which is very much the conservative argument of the last 30 years, isn't it?
It's absolutely the conservative argument. I mean, Reagan talked about welfare queens. Reagan talked about how there were some people who were not worthy of being helped by government because they were lazy, they were stupid, they didn't deserve – our help. So conservatives have argued their whole lives against equality. And whenever a new group has strived for equality, whether it's gays and lesbians, whether it's African Americans, whether it's immigrants, whoever it is,
and even when it was women,
when it was women,
exactly.
Much of the time, I mean, they've always argued against it. I mean, Pat Robertson, not that long ago, wrote a fundraising letter where he said feminism is the equivalent of witchcraft. I mean, he uses the same language from 200 years ago, and so they have always argued against equality.
You give your readers a great history lesson that mentions also how progressives have often compromised their values. Is that happening today?
Well, it always happens. You know, you compromise in politics. The question is whether you compromise over the right things or not. There has never been a president, no matter how progressive, FDR, Abraham Lincoln, who I would argue was a great progressive, LBJ, you know, who was a great progressive on domestic issues, but not on the Vietnam War. There's never been a president who hasn't compromised some of the time. The question is whether they are willing to use their political capital to do the right thing most of the time and to do the right thing in a big way. I mean, one of the big, I think, debates in history has been whether to be slow, cautious, incremental, or whether to do big change. And I argue that there are definitely times in history where there are big change moments because leaders are bold enough to make them, and that those times have been the best of times in America.
Now, I would assume, given the last 30 years culminating in whatever adjectives you want to use about the two wars were in quagmires, ill thought out, ill considered, unnecessary, etc., and the crash of our economy and the global economy, that I would say now's a moment when people are waking up, and all but the most dyed in the wool are willing to see through or question that conservative dogma that's been running our world. So this is potentially a big change moment.
I think it absolutely is. I think there are times in history when the stars align. And one of the things that's happened in recent years is that you look back, for example, 2005. You know, Bush had just won that election. Karl Rove was talking about a permanent Republican majority. The Republicans had picked up several seats in the Senate in the previous, you know, couple of elections. Democrats and liberals were pretty discouraged. But in that year, we had Katrina. We had the disastrous, you know, execution of the war in Iraq. We had the Terry Schiavo
incident. Because I was wondering.
And we had Social Security privatization fight. And the American people looked at all of that and basically realized conservatism sucks. You know, I mean, and you know, it all kind of came to a head in the fall of that year. And there was like a seismic shift in terms of the polling. And ever since then, Democrats have established clear leads in terms of their favorability ratings versus Republicans. Progressive issues have advanced
Let me say a couple of things. One is, wasn't it true that issues have favored progressives at least at some kind of majority for years? It's been electoral politics that didn't.
Yeah, I mean, on most issues, I think the progressive side has been the more popular side. Republicans and conservatives have been very good at framing issues, and they've been able to get people to focus on certain things rather than others.
Well, one of the things that I've said is I've called it the Bush-Rowe folks electoral savants, only good at demonizing their opponents. Their opponents, demonizing them, winning elections, and having no inclination or talent toward governance.
Well, clearly they don't know how to govern. They don't know anything about how to govern. They love power. They love being able to hand out government contracts to their friends, hand out tax breaks to their friends. They love that kind of stuff. but they don't know how to govern.
Right.
That's been very clear from the last few years.
The other thing that I had thought, and let me just ask you about this, was, and then we'll move into the present, onto the future, was that in that 2004 election, which it's interesting how quickly the country woke up. You know, I think Schiavo really started it and Katrina sunk, clinched it. But that I actually had the feeling that there was a bonding of a very primitive sort with Bush after 9/11 in trauma, you know, children, primates, you know, they bond with the alpha male kind of. And that trauma hadn't quite been broken enough by the 2004 election. And then it just fell apart.
Well, I think that partly I think first of all you're absolutely right in terms of the trauma thing, and I think I liken it to the case of of an abuser. You know, you've got that powerful kind of father figure who occasionally hits people and abuses his family, and that there's a trauma there too. But then he does his protector thing, you know, at the same time. And so it was almost a psychological reaction.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. My last guest before the 2004 election was Robert Lifton to talk about trauma and that sort of thing, because it seemed to me that was what was crucial at the time. It seems to me that this is a moment, as we're talking about, where the shades have fallen and people are looking at things they haven't been willing to look at before. For instance, they have seen that Wall Street, which they sort of went along and thought they must be doing right because I'm doing okay, everyone's doing okay.
Stocks are going up. Yeah,
suddenly they see it's a scam.
Right.
They realize, well, I guess the wars were scams too, et cetera, et cetera. Is it a moment when two issues that I think have only survived because the regular people haven't questioned them, that is the war on drugs and the need for single-payer health care, have an opportunity here because once you shed light on the arguments for and against, there's very little rationale for the side that's held sway, which is that we waste money on a war on drugs and we refuse to consider single-payer health care. Do you think those might have some shot in this time of sort of people waking up?
You know, I do think that big change is in the air and that people are much more open to very, very big changes on a variety of things. I don't think any of these things are going to be easy. You know, I think that special interests and traditional thinking about these issues is going to be hard to overcome. And Democrats are very cautious. I talk in my book about something I call the culture of caution on the Democratic side, that Democrats scare themselves too much of the time in terms of when thinking about big change. But I think in both of those issues, there are possibilities for much bigger change. And I think we may see a multi-step process, for example.
In both of them, isn't it true?
In both of them. You know, you see, for example, Eric Holder saying, hey, I'm not going to worry about medical marijuana in California anymore. You see Hillary Clinton, you know, saying to Mexico, you know, a lot of the problem is us. You know, you're starting to see breaks in that. And on healthcare, I think that it's probably not likely in this year that we would get be able to pass single payer. But if you pass a public option, which Obama has proposed and which seems like it's got a shot, I think that is the first step towards single payer.
In other words, when we now see conservatives saying, well, after years of saying that we have to go private because it's more efficient, then saying, wait, if you put a public option out there, it isn't fair because—
Right. It's not fair. Those poor insurance companies won't be able to compete.
Oh, well—
You know, very, very sad about
just
that.
Just as we said.
Right. But I do think it's a first step because if people have the opportunity to have decent health care plan through the public option— They'll take it. It'll force insurance companies to radically change what they do, which is great. But over time, people may say, hey, this public option's, pretty damn good. Let's keep going in this direction. So I see it as something it's not going to happen this year, but it could happen, in the not too distant future.
Again, as a consultant, if you are someone who believes single payer is the rational choice, and for anyone who hasn't heard me rail about this over the years, if one thought I have is, if you look at Wall Street and you say, well, I thought they were playing fair and square, they were scamming us. Right. Then you look at insurance that takes over 20% in overhead and administration, while Medicare takes about 4%. You go, well, that's 16% of that huge amount that we spend, more than any other country in the world, on healthcare isn't going to healthcare. Maybe that's a scam. And that eventually, as I say, but if you were someone who supported...
It's over 30% in a lot of companies.
Okay. Amazing.
Yeah.
If you were someone who favors single payer, should you now keep pushing single payer so that the public option comes out, or should you really put your energy in making sure that there is a viable public option?
Well, I don't see those two as mutually exclusive.
Good.
People who believe in single payer, and there's a lot of activists who do, there's not a downside to them continuing to push for single payer. That puts pressure behind that movement and that idea, and I think it encourages people in Congress to say, well, we can't do that for you right now, but we'll give you the public option, which in my view, as I said, is a first step toward it.
Okay. In the bigger picture, ever since Clinton's election in 92, actually, I've been reminding people that FDR was elected on a fairly moderate platform.
Yes.
And it was only because the people, the farmers, the unionists,
yeah,
the homeless, held his feet to the fire, that that they pushed him to be more progressive. We didn't do that with Clinton. Are we doing it? How can we do it? What should listeners be doing in terms of Obama?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. You know, no president has ever done big things without a push from movements. Lincoln never would have, emancipated the slaves without the abolitionist movement. Teddy Roosevelt surely wouldn't have broken up the big corporate trusts without the progressive and populist movements. Woodrow Wilson sure as hell wouldn't have supported women having the right to vote without the suffragist movement. And FDR could not have done what he did without the labor movement. In fact, he told labor leaders, make me do it.
That's right. That's the thing
on the New Deal. And of course we know that without Martin Luther King, John Lewis, the civil rights movement, none of the civil rights changes would have happened just because LBJ or JFK were nice guys. I mean, you have to have movements from below. And I was in the Clinton White House. We didn't have that. And I write in the book about this. We felt no pressure from the left. We felt no urgency from progressives. We felt all the pressure was coming from the right. And of course.
And from the money.
and from the money. And of course we responded to that. Clinton responded to that. And so progressives have to keep the heat on. They have to keep pushing. They can do it in a way that's constructive. But
let me cut in for 1 second, Mike. We got about 3.5 minutes left.
Yeah.
That's what I want you to talk about. From what you've written about, from what you've studied, from the organization I know you're involved with, and from the tour you've just been doing, mm-hmm, where you're speaking to a lot of people, what would you say to listeners about, the plan, the steps, the actions, and so on for holding Obama's feet to the fire?
Well, I wrote a blog post the other day that I called progressive multitasking. We're going to have to be able to do a lot of different things at the same time to build this movement. One is, I really believe that online activism is key to doing this. We didn't have that going for us in the 90s, and we sorely missed it. And it's a great way to plug into national organizations. You plug into blogs. You plug into all of the different ways of national activism. Second thing I would say is, whatever organization you're involved in, remind that organization that they're part of a bigger movement. This is not about a single issue here and a single issue there. And that was the problem in the Clinton years. All the progressive groups were single issue groups, and they would work on their issue, but they wouldn't help each other. Nobody had each other's back. Nobody was supporting each other.
Quite the contrary on the right.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the NRA was running ads on term limits. The Christian Coalition was running ads on taxes. They didn't care. They were part of a movement. That's how the organizations that we're involved in need to think. We all need to work together to make this happen. I think that's really important. I think the third thing is, local organizing remains really important, whatever congressional district you're in. And I remind people, you know, when I'm in Massachusetts or New York City or you know, some districts here in California, even if you've got a liberal Democrat representing you, you still need to push that person, because Democrats need to think big, and Democrats aren't used to thinking big. They're used to thinking, oh, wow, if we have 2 million extra kids to S-CHIP, that's a big change. It's a good thing, but it's not transformational. So we need to get Democrats to think in terms of big, bold ideas, and to do that local organizing.
So in other words, if your local is a Democrat, is a progressive Democrat, you want to keep pushing them to be as progressive as they can be, so that, again, they're not going bowing to the money or right. the fear of some
right
else.
Or and being satisfied with small incremental changes. We need to get all of our elected officials to be thinking bigger. And we also need, you know, I know from working in the White House, from working in the Obama transition, that local efforts do get noticed. You know, when something big is happening in San Diego, people start buzzing about it. If something is working in Oregon, people start buzzing about it. It does really matter for local organizing to break through in cities and counties.
In your last 30 seconds, can you tell people some organizations or websites that can help them in this holding?
Well, you know, there are some great organizations. Of course, I'm a big fan of MoveOn.org, which has added 2 million members in the last 6 months. I mean, they're doing a great job of building their base, continuing their organizing. I think that, you know, I would encourage people to really get into the blogs, blogging to support independent media in that way. I think that's really important. Radio shows, Rachel Maddow, The more voices that we have on media, the better off we are.
And good old Pacifica.
Good old Pacifica.
Okay.
And keep up your support of Pacifica. Absolutely.
So again, the book is The Progressive Revolution. He's Mike Lux. The website is theprogressiverevolution.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others at any time during the week by linking to our podcast. You can also sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. Email me at TEMcNally@Mac.com, TEMcNally@Mac.com, to learn about how to do that and also get on a list that I send out weekly telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, what the issues are going to be. Thank you, Mike Lux. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much for having me on.